This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Print is dead. No more newspapers, no more magazines, no love letters. Bookstores and libraries cease to exist. Communication is controlled by tiny handheld gadgets. Ah, this is not some far-off future. This is the world, the 2016 setting of the novel The Word Exchange. Elena Graydon is the author of The Word Exchange. It is her debut novel, and she is on the program with us now. Elena Graydon, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be with you.
It's great to be here. People will recognize that name, Graydon.
Indeed.
And Terry and Joe, the hosts of The People's Pharmacy, are indeed your parents.
They are indeed, and they record here every week.
They record right across the hall, right here in the studio. We are here to talk about your book, which you authored by yourself.
I got lots of help, just like most other writers, including from my parents.
And a daughter-father relationship plays an important part in this book. So tell us about it. What's the premise of this book? Give us a little of the outline.
Sure. So as you said, it's set a few years in the future, and the death of print is even more of a reality than it is today. And the main characters all work together at a dictionary. And it's sort of like the last print dictionary that's ever going to be published. And a week before it's supposed to hit shelves, the head editor, the chief editor, whose name is Doug, he goes missing. And he vanishes not just from the dictionary office, but also his daughter notices that this sort of encyclopedia-like entry that's devoted to him in the dictionary vanishes from the digital edition of the book that they edit. And so obviously this throws her into a tailspin, especially because a few weeks before he disappeared, he actually told her that if anything were to happen to him, he wanted to use the name Alice to communicate with her. And so when she doesn't find him in his office, but she does find this code word, she sort of tumbles down the proverbial rabbit hole, and she finds herself in a world that is like Alice's Looking Glass world, less and less the one that she thought that she knew, where words and meanings even start to sort of lose their sense.
It's a wonderful book because it reads like a thriller. It is a detective. It's a mystery. A lot of very important ideas and philosophical ideas are carried through in this, and very contemporary ideas that we're wrestling with today, including these kind of missing entries, everything so dependent on words and symbols that mean so much to us. Well, if I lose control of that, then what does that mean in terms of the world I live in and how I interpret it? Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, I think it started sort of the kernel of the idea came to me after a house fire. But backing up just a little bit, I'm part of this transitional generation. We were the last to really engage with print media in a real and unsentimental way. And I think—
Did you actually have a notebook?
I did, actually.
Like a spiral notebook with a pen?
Yes, like every single day I was always taking notes in these notebooks. And I think, too, that in my family, this transition from print to digital was especially poignant because books were a huge, important part of our life. And in fact, you know, I grew up here in Durham and my grandparents were just down the street. And my grandfather was a used and rare book dealer with tens of thousands of volumes. So they were in his house. They overflowed into our house. And many of my, you know, most cherished memories from childhood are of reading those books aloud with my family. And so I've always been really fascinated by this transition from print to digital, but I've also always been, you know, a little wary of it too. And I think that's also partly informed by the fact that early on I had some experiences that reinforced for me the fragility potentially of print media. I was like a Carolina Friends School lifer. I went to school there all the way through, which was amazing. And then when I was 17, I had this incredible opportunity to study abroad for a semester in Beijing with a host family. And that happened to be right around the time that email was really taking off. And I was thrilled, of course, to have a way to communicate with my family and my friends back home. But I also sort of was reminded or discovered how vulnerable virtual space could potentially be, both in the sense that, you know, I would write these long emails and the digital infrastructure just wasn't always great yet. So I might hit send and, you know, they'd vanish into thin air. But we also were all really aware of the fact, being in China, that there were certain websites we couldn't access. Sometimes they'd disappear overnight. And we knew that what we were writing could at least potentially be read and be censored. And, you know, I've had a little deja vu following the NSA revelations here in this country. that, you know, this, if we migrate all of our data to this sort of provisional, fragile space, the potential at least exists much more than in print for people who may want to make narratives change or make inconvenient facts disappear to manipulate or erase them. So I've been really interested in that.
And at the same time, of course, you're learning another language. So you're starting to think more deeply about the impact of words and how they affect us. And then you had an encounter with the OED.
I did. And that is where the house fire sort of comes in. When I was a senior in college, I was home the day before my thesis was due, and I was frantically finishing the last chapter of my thesis, and I smelled smoke. And then I saw this dark black smoke roiling up from my downstairs neighbor's apartment, and then I heard glass exploding. So without even stopping to get my shoes, I ran down to the street, and I saw that it was too late, that our house was engulfed in flame, and fortunately, no one was hurt. But, you know, we did lose pretty much everything. I lost all my my books. I lost my laptop. It kind of turned into this charred piece of mush.
Your laptop with a thesis on it?
Well, and my all the print pages of my thesis were also destroyed. But my thesis was saved because I'd been emailing it to myself as I went along. And naturally, I was very thrilled for the existence of digital media on that day and on many other days. But it did get me thinking, again, more about these questions that I'd kind of been carrying with me, because a house fire is an isolated, traumatic incident. It's really rare. But I think we've all sort of had the experience of losing things from virtual space, you know, an audio file or an email or sometimes a whole database gets destroyed. And so I sort of thought, you know, if things only exist in this digital realm, what are the potential ramifications of that? So a few months after the house fire, when I graduated from college, my parents gave me as a graduation gift a copy of the Oxford American Dictionary because all mine had been burned in the fire. And I took it with me to a residency at the Penland School of Crafts, which is near Asheville. And I was going to use some of the line drawings inside for a screen printing project. And as I was flipping through, I saw these encyclopedia-like entries for some famous people. And the idea that I had was, what if one of those were to disappear? What would the story behind that be? And that is, in fact, how the book begins.
I'm sorry, I said OED, but it was the Oxford American
that
you had.
The American offshoot, yeah. So.
Will you read for us from your new
book?
Sure.
I'm just going to read from the very beginning. So there's not really anything that you need to know. On a very cold and lonely Friday last November, my father disappeared from the dictionary. And not only from the big glass building on Broadway where its offices were housed. On that night, my father, Douglas Samuel Johnson, chief editor of the North American Dictionary of the English Language, slipped from the actual artifact he'd helped compose. That was before the dictionary died, letters expiring on the page. Before the virus, before our language dissolved like so much melting snow. It was before I nearly lost everything I love. Words I've come to learn are pulleys through time, portals into other minds. Without words, what remains? Indecipherable customs, strange rites, blighted hearts. Without words, we're history's orphans, our lives and thoughts erased. Before my father vanished, before the first signs of SO-111 arrived, I'd reflected very little on our way of life. The changing world I'd come of age in, slowly bereft of books and love letters, photographs and maps, takeout menus, timetables, liner notes and diaries, was a world I'd come to accept. If I was missing out on things, they were things I didn't think to miss. How could we miss words? We were drowning in a sea of text. A new one arrived, chiming every minute.
Elena Graydon reading from her debut novel, The Word Exchange. You've got so many great ideas just in those first few paragraphs. You introduced the idea of a virus, and then words as pulleys through time. And I think about the impact of viruses biologically on us and how they have, without our knowing it, changed our biology. There's a lot about us that happened because of an infection.
Absolutely.
We're not who we were generations ago, and yet we kind of think that we're evolved. So there are these sinister elements, but also just the evolution of words changes how we understand ourselves and our history.
It does. And language evolution is a really natural process. There's a big difference between language evolution and language coercion, say, where, for instance, a colonizing power decides that they want to impose a new language on a people. So using language as sort of a weapon of subjugation and imperialism. And then what happens in the book is somewhere in between. It's not strictly language evolution. It's not strictly language coercion. But a small group of people decide that they want to sort of try to co-opt language and use it for their own ends. And of course, the consequences are pretty disastrous.
As a member of that liminal generation who once knew a spiral notebook, and now are you devoted to your smartphone?
I am. I'm just as devoted to it as anyone, I'm sorry to say.
What part evolution and what part coercion do you think is playing a role in all this? And how do you think it's going to end up for us in words?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that I am as dependent on the internet and on my iPhone as anyone. And I've been so grateful for so many of the advances that have come along, and especially in the medical sphere, but in all sorts of areas. And, you know, researching the book didn't make me afraid of technology, you know, but it did make me a lot more aware of its possibilities and of the possibilities of what could potentially be lost if we depend too heavily on our devices. So, more than anything, I sort of wanted to just offer people what I hope will be an engaging and entertaining story. But I also did want to add to this larger cultural conversation that we've been having about the ways in which technology, you know, enters into our lives, maybe intrudes into our lives, and what that relationship, what that might be doing to our ability to be reflective, to be creative, to form intimate relationships with people when all of our interactions are mediated through screens. So it's a process that's happening and it'll continue to happen. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But we have control over how it unfolds and the stakes are potentially pretty high, I think.
Control so far.
Right.
All right, Elena. Well, it's a wonderful book. Well received critically.
Thank you so much.
Debut novel. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Elena Graydon, author of The Word Exchange. She's going to speak tonight, 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And again on Saturday at 11 a.m., McIntyre's Fine Books at Farrington Village. And you can find out more about the book and Elena's visits and readings at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Our technical director is Robin Copley. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.